This is Zach Clark, and you're listening to Paper Cuts. The podcast that talks to artists and zinesters and publishers about the books they make. I'm your host, Christopher Cardobicus, and I'm currently in San Francisco for the San Francisco Art Book Fair, where it's been an inspiring weekend with so many awesome books and so many amazing book people. One of these amazing people is my host for this evening, Zach Clark. Thank you so much for joining us at Paper Cuts at this bar that I've forgotten the name of.
Junior. Although now we're not sure if we should endorse it, but yeah, I still like this bar.
I am so far having a good time.
Great.
Zach is a printmaker, book artist, publisher, and educator in the Bay Area. He publishes under the project name National Monument Press and also the collaborative project Shoot Studio, where he works with Amy Burek.
Yep.
All right, great. Should have checked that pronunciation before we started recording. But Zach is a pillar of the publishing community, and I'm very, very happy to have him here at Paper Cuts after a long Saturday of the book fair. Zach, once again, welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Very glad to be here.
So yeah, we mentioned the bar briefly, but Zach, can you give us a little bit of a lay of the land? Where are we? What's happening?
We are in the Mission in San Francisco. A historical arts neighborhood in San Francisco that have recent history that I don't actually live in. I live in Oakland on the other side. I don't come over here all that often, but when I do, this is where I come. So
yeah. I partially wanted to be asking you about place because I feel like your photo-based books and zines are rooted in landscape and geography, and you have this really wonderful way of embedding personal narratives into the space of your books and getting us these wonderful moments of like psychogeography. And I think that there's a lot happening with how you're able to capture these immediate moments and translating the photography you take on film into these dramatically reso-printed books. And I wanted to ask you first, this is a very long preamble.
I know, love it.
To just get a sense of how you feel geography plays in your work, and where that sense of location or space started to take root for you.
I describe my personal work as having to do with locational memory, and that both being about the memory of a place and how it changes over time, but then also one's relationship to a place and how that lives in a largely like memory-based space. That I think I really started thinking about it that way when I was working on my thesis work in grad school. That I made a bunch of work that was about Poland. I spent the summer of between my first and second year of grad school in Poland, and which is where my family immigrated from. My family, I have come to find, is a very typical early 20th century Polish family that once they came to the United States, they were American.
Yeah. Do you know when they immigrated?
My great grandpa came in 1907. No, it was pre-war, 1930 something. Normally I remember this, but I'm spacing it right now. My family comes from the mountains in the south of Poland, which is also like a weird population. They're called the Goryl people. It's a specific ethnic group that most people know about because of their they have this really specific form of folk music that doesn't exist anywhere else in musicology. And it's this interesting call and response and multiple time signature music.
Did you grow up around this at all?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And it's all in the Tatra Mountains that kind of throughout time has moved ownership quite a few times, as much as Poland has. And all my family's from Chicago, which is very, very Polish. But a lot of what got me really interested in Poland was that over the course of 3 years, both of my mom's parents and then my mom all passed away. And so any sort of connection to my family didn't talk about being Polish to begin with. In fact, like, being Polish was kind of derogatory. And so the idea that there was this place that no one in my family had ever gone back to, and no one talked about or knew anything about. I never knew any Polish. That was part of what made it really interesting to me. Then I spent the summer there, and I went to the town, which is in air quotes, that my family is from, which is literally a road. And after World War II, they changed the name of the town to add the mountain, the name of the mountains into the town, hoping it would boost tourism, but it's still a road.
Yeah.
And it was one of those where it's like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't talk about this place either. But then I started to think a lot about how, even if they did, like, what, like, how would I know what they're talking about anyways? And also, like, the way a place moves, the way a place changes over time, like, I can tell you about what living in the Bay Area 10 years ago was like, but that's not at all the Bay Area now.
Yeah.
And that's just in the last 10 years. And so similarly, someone telling you about the Polish, the rural Polish mountains they grew up in 50 years later, that means nothing to me. Plus I have no visual context for that. And so that idea that a place, like most places exist in our memories, at their, like, most distilled version, but also like our foggiest version.
Yeah.
And so also on familial stuff, I also have a lot of mental health, memory degradation issues in a lot of my family. So that idea of that memories are constantly slipping away and are inevitably going to slip away is also, I think, a big part of my interest in the looseness of space.
Yeah,
I should also probably pause to say, you said really nice things about my books, but like at the end of the day, they're really blurry photographs.
That is not the best way to be talking about them, Zach.
Yeah,
I am going to have to airplane you. This is not good.
They're very painterly, which my background actually, my undergrad was in painting. I don't know why.
Yeah,
it happened. And so I still
think that's like common for undergrad. Like you just go into something because that is what seems to be the thing to do.
Yeah, I originally went to school for photography and then took all the photography classes that were available at the school I went to. And then I dropped out and then was in a band on tour for a while. And then I went back to school, had a grad student who taught my drawing class. It was like, yeah, you could be a painter. And I was like, okay. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
but because of that, a lot of my language is still very painterly, whether I like it or not. And I've lost the original thread of where I was going.
It does a really good job of kind of setting the stage for things. And so a couple questions right off the bat. Where did you go to grad school at?
UC Davis.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really curious history to kind of like meander through to like leave photography, come back to it, just like in terms of materials and practices, but also to reestablish connections with like a family lineage and a place.
Yeah.
And trying to process that. There's something that I'm making a very like immediate surface connection between having a history of like, family memory loss, but also the choice to use film photography as something that even though it is a little bit grainier or potentially blurry with how you take the photos, I feel like that's more of a solid state information grab versus like digital photography, which is JPEGs, then is lossy, famously.
Well, and not to jump over you, sorry.
No, please.
Part of why I went back to shooting film, and I really have a hard time considering myself a photographer, even talking about photography. But part of why I moved back to film was because, you know, I got my digital Rebel in 2002 that now I couldn't even make 8x10 prints of because the resolution was so shitty.
But
that still cost me $2,000 in 2004. And so like, and after I made enough leaps of DSLRs, I was like, what am I doing? Like I can shoot film and I can scan in every time. Like we need higher resolution for things.
Yeah.
So that kind of archivalness, which is funny because that's not something I worry about too much in my practice otherwise, that was appealing to me.
Yeah.
But then also, I shoot all of my photographs with a Holga, which is a like crappy plastic toy camera that like usually most people are using because it's the cheapest way to shoot medium format film because they used to only cost like $20. But they're plastic, they have light leaks, you have to focus, but you're just guessing. You manually advance, so like they're really hard things to work with anyways.
That kind of like accidental overlap of images, I think also very obviously ties to the idea of memory and how things are overwritten or maybe not.
Yeah.
And like literal folds in the brain, like folding over memories. And that idea of just like being in a landscape and traversing it regularly to like create grooves, I guess.
You're talking about that camera and I was like, you're just talking about a risograph.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, well, I joke, semi-joking, that I take really bad photographs and then I print them through a photograph and those two pillars fall over to lean on each other to make a stronger structure. Because they're both crappy, but like when they come together at a tension point, they make something that's really nice.
And actually, we can call out our question from the audience. Mr. Paul Short is in the window above us in the bar. And that is another question I wanted to ask you, is the idea of like this photography process being translated through the risograph and how you see photography and risography really melding.
So,
and collapsing over each other in a little like A-frame is one way.
I am going to be full of contradictions here. I think that RISO is a terrible medium for photography.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you are somebody who is taking digital photographs and then you're wanting to make reproductions of your digital photographs. The fact that you already saw them as a photo, you have an idea of what they're supposed to be, and you're never going to get those colors right. RISO is just loose on its own, unless you're Travis Schaefer, who like is a witch, and I don't know how he does what he does. And so, like, there has to be a looseness there that is kind of antithetical to a lot of straightforward photography. But you know, even down to we're guessing on our color palettes, and so not guessing, we're creating our own color palettes that. We're never going to recreate things perfectly. And so with me, no one ever sees, I scan my photos, my negatives in, and no one ever sees a printed version of it otherwise. Like I might share a screen capture on Instagram or something, but nobody sees them in any method besides the finished RISO product, which is also part of why I don't really talk about it with photography because they end up being RISO prints. So because of that, when I take on contract jobs for folks that do photo, I run into the problem a lot where people see my work and are like, oh, like we'd love for you to do, like, could you print this thing for us? Here are my iPhone photos. I have to be like, it's not going to look like what you think it's going to look like.
Yeah.
And so this kind of gets to a thing I struggle with RISO as a whole of the fact that to do really good RISO, you have to own the machines. You have to know the machines really well.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're all working with a limited color palette, we're building a color palette around the work we want to make. Or if you're a smart commercial RISO shop, you're building a palette around what is going to be the widest breadth. That's not what we do. We don't run black, for instance. Those of us who own the machines, it is cheap for us. And we are making really good prints because we have the time, we have the knowledge, where a lot of times with like public access prints and community access shops, people are going in and want to do a four color print in an hour. And they're going to have track marks, and they're going to have smudges, and they're going to be wet. It's not their fault.
Yeah.
They don't have access to the machines, but it's also, it's not like an etching press. It's pretty hard to break. It's really easy to break a RISO. And so like we really struggle about any sort of community access kind of for that reason, because I still need to print to pay my bills.
Yeah.
And so like if someone drops a drum, like my fluorescent pink drum is out, like I'm at $1,000.
Yeah, it's difficult to really open it up.
Yeah.
So, and also for our listeners at home, you are referencing Shoot Studio.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What is Shoot Studio?
Yeah, so this is one that... Shoot Studio is the studio that myself and Amy Burick run that kind of came up as a coincidence. Amy has been doing Rezo since 2014.
Yeah.
And I had done a little bit of Rezo with her. We actually shared a wall in our old studio space for a month before I left for grad school.
Yeah.
And then after grad school, I got my Rezo. And so we were both doing some Rezo with each other, using each other's machines because of drum scarcity.
Yeah.
And then after a few years of that, we both really wanted a two drum machine. And we found one that we were like, oh, let's buy this two drum machine together.
Yeah.
And then once we bought a machine together, we were like, oh, well, I guess like we need to get a studio together. And then it was all in my garage for about 6 months. And then in March of 2020, we were supposed to move into Kala, a printmaking institution here in Berkeley, that we were going to be like pseudo resident fellows, something of that nature.
Yeah.
And kind of be running the print shop out of and public programming out of the downstairs. And then we all know what happened in March 2020. And so we did end up being inside of Kala for 2 years, but there was no activity happening at Kala. And over that time, we acquired a few more Rezos. We're now in East Oakland. We have 6 Rezos and 27 drums or something like that.
That's a lot of Rezos.
And we've decommissioned Rezos. We've brought new ones in. We've got a setup that we like right now. With that, a thing that I think is really interesting and exciting, but everyone else thinks is strange. Shoot Studio is a place and a rarely updated Instagram account.
Okay.
Otherwise, Amy and I are essentially two people running our own businesses out of the same space with shared equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Shoot Studio doesn't exist on paper as a business anywhere.
Yeah.
Which is something I like telling people about because you can just start making stuff with friends and share equipment and call yourself a thing.
Yeah.
And it's not hard. And I've met a lot of people.
Born is part of the world.
Yeah. Where it's no, we're both just our own companies. And but we
so
take turns buying
it. Contract Zach Clark to do their friends.
Yeah, and so we do have an email address that Amy and I talk, do you want to do this job or I'll take this job. Amy has a small kid, I'm also teaching. So we both have our own other life stuff that's also really nice because if I can't do a job, Amy will and vice versa. So if one of us has a really big project, we can help each other out. So, but it also makes buying a booklet maker we both only had to spend half of. And
that's
so that's really nice.
Yeah. I appreciate that conversation because I feel like something else that you've been able to bring about in your writing in some of your books is and how you talk about your practice in some of the promotional material is a real honesty about the economics of what you're doing and how that actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think in one of your more recent books, you talked about the artist's life as being outside of a real life, but being very tethered to a reality that is what we're all living in, capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate the economics talks with the studio. How do you approach an almost not radical openness or honesty, but just how do you see your business ethics or your ethics as a human being played out in your practice and business practice?
That is a great question. So I think where I might start with that is one of the examples that I kind of point to often. I have this Rezo book on my table that costs $420.
Mm-hmm.
People in our art book world, think a $400 Rezo book is insane, or a $400 book at a table in our fair is kind of nuts anyways. Although this week people are picking up, which makes me so happy. Normally people won't touch it. But then I priced this book that is a super intensive, all hand bound, all drum leafed, all four color with letterpress inserts sewn into the drum leaf. It's a little more on a fine press type book anyways, but it's still a Rizzo book. And I priced that book at exactly what an artist would have to charge to make money if they were to pay me as a contract printer to do the identical edition.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wrote a whole essay about it that is on a music newsletter I write that was explaining, like, this is what it would cost you to pay me to print this. Like, this is how much the film, like, the 5 years of film, I used about as many rolls, and this is how I processed it. Like, that's how you get the price of... $420 was, like, the entire cost of the project times three.
Yeah.
That doesn't include even any of my binding hours or anything like that. So, like, we're talking just the printing and, like, getting to the that version of it. And I think that's really important, because to go back to one of the things that I struggle with Rizzo is, especially when we're talking about how Rizzo's cheap, it's cheap if you own the machine.
Yeah.
Because you don't pay yourself labor. And when you hire me to print it, I'd love to print it for you at cost, but it's taking me a week, and I need to make that.
Yeah.
Which I think is a tricky thing with Rizzo, is that when people come to us for printing, they're used to the idea that Rizzo is supposed to be cheap. And I have to explain, especially setup costs, is the type of thing where it's like, yeah, Rizzo is cheap if you make 100 copies, because I'm spending time, but also I've got to print 20 prints in order to get a quality flat print that then I can use as a test for the registration of the next one. So we're going through, if you send me a single four color print, I've made 100 prints to get there.
Yeah.
And so, like, talking about that waste is actually a big part of how I explain the cost to folks. That's going to exist no matter what.
Yeah.
And so also, like, yeah, we're not the cheapest Rizzo printers. Like, there are, you can get Rizzo printing for much cheaper than from us, but also we live in the Bay Area, and, like, that's also just art economics. Our rent is way more than if we were in Kansas City. Nothing against oddities, they're great. Kansas City is a lot cheaper than here, and that's the place I talk about moving if I leave here. So there's that on the contract printing side of things. We also, like, we do an okay amount of contract printing. We're extremely lucky to be in the Bay Area, where we have Floss, we have Tiny Splendor, we have Boho, we have Kolpa, we have 12 people doing Rizzo printing in some capacity for the public. And so that also means, like, we don't have to compete with each other, because we all know there's a ton of us doing it. So, like, whoever prints it. When one of us is busy, we send the job to somebody else. Like, if somebody tries to undercut us, we all talk to each other and are like, oh, did you get this weird print, like, request from this? So don't do that if you're listening to this and want to, like, make shops compete against each other, because we're not going to. So there's that. I don't know if this is entering or is on the question, but my model for publishing is very much, since I was in a band in my 20s, I can't... My professional economy is entirely that from what it's like to be an indie band and be on an independent music label. That's a lot of the economics I work with. So with all of my books that I publish with other folks, I pay for 100% of the cost up front. Unless there's been a couple of times where an artist wanted a really, really specific card stock that was going to be really expensive for the cover. Yeah. They bought that and we built it into our recoup cost. But typically I'm paying for everything up front, so nothing, it doesn't cost an artist anything. And then I make the money back first. Usually that happens on presale. Which I've gotten lucky that we're selling pretty well on pre-sale with my books for the last few years. And then from there, we split any profits 50-50, but then we also split the edition. Once we've recouped, you get your 50%, I get my 50% of the books. And then also that makes it so that we kind of clean our hands of having to exchange money in the future, which makes our books easier. So everything's a 50-50 split once things have been paid for. And that's all at cost. Again, I'm not, like, building in my labor or anything like that. And that, partly because the artist also isn't being paid for their labor of making the book. And so it feels like a fair, we're just going to pay for what the book costs to make.
And I think one of the other things I am very appreciative of in your practice is how collaborative it is. like a big arm of what you're publishing is work you're doing with other people, mm-hmm. not just work for hire or their work specifically, but things you're producing together. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about like you as an artist, kind of, is it like a split brain thing? Like, are you, do you think about your work as your work and the collaborations as a different aspect of your work and trying to feed both entities? Or do you like pendulum swing between the two? If you are like trying to map out what you do in a given year, is there like more of one versus the other?
I will start by saying one of the things I love about publishing is that I was just really stuck this spring, but I'm still making books with other people. So I was still like, it's like I was still working out. I was still keeping the chops.
Still making everything happen.
Yeah. And so it's okay if I don't have anything to say for a minute. Because I'm still making things. And most of my projects, I have a couple of artists. I've done several books with this illustrator, Min Ho, who she knows exactly what she's doing in file setup. And since I'm who taught her how to do Rezo back in an old studio, like I also know she knows how to set the files up, but also how I want them set up. She sends me ready to print books.
Amazing.
I make a couple of value changes and then I put it together. So, though, but that's kind of the rarity. For the most part, I'm working with people who don't work in print or books. And especially when I was first starting out, I was making works with a lot of performance artists and installation artists and folks that they actually, part of the excitement of making a book was that they actually had a thing that they could have available and they could sell. It was a physical thing. And so because of that, it's super collaborative in the making, which is a whole other conversation that I'm like trying to chew on these days of like what that means. I've had a couple of artists that like want my name on the cover of the book. And it's like, oh, like, yeah, this was a thing. Should I be? I don't know. Yeah. And I haven't come to a conclusion about I have a non-qualitative opinion about that. Like, that didn't make sense. Hopefully you know what I'm trying to say. I don't know what I think about it. So,
When you're like really working on something with someone and the idea of like how you parse out a project in terms of credit, like, if you're almost like, something I feel about publishing work for people is that you're the mechanic and you are making this thing a little bit tighter and making it run better. And like they're developing the system and making the whole machine really work, but you're like tightening the screws and like, all right, let's talk about concepts a little bit to tighten things up.
Yeah.
Sometimes your hand is maybe more.
Yeah. I'd say sometimes that's true. Sometimes we're talking about the book together from the start.
Yeah. Yeah.
That also is a little like harder to navigate, I guess. Fair brain just like flew out of me. To go back to like music industry brain, like I think about it a lot with like the producer on a record usually does a lot of writing. And like is really responsible for the sound. And a band goes to a specific producer because they want that sound.
Yeah, yeah.
But like it's also not like, you know, Brett McTernan isn't on the cover of every single metal record he's ever like produced. But people know. So there's an interesting thing about credit, you know. Yeah, I don't know. But then, like, we have producers of movies that, like, they're the top billing, like, you know, which, you know, whatever. But I would say to go back to your original question of, like, how I balance it out, most of my books usually come up organically of a conversation of, like, hey, do you want to make a thing together? Okay, cool. And then 2 years later, a thing has been made. To the chagrin of a lot of my collaborators, I'm on a zero deadlines. I'm like, it gets made when it gets made.
Yeah.
And if it never gets made, it probably wasn't supposed to be made.
Yeah.
And I've made enough books that I shouldn't have made, but like they've never sold. It's like maybe we didn't need to waste the paper. And you know. Yeah. And so if something isn't getting done, like that's okay. And so I always kind of have a backlog of stuff that I'm working on with people, but then also with like teaching, sometimes working on just other people's stuff is a lot easier because I don't have to use my brain. But the really boring answer is a lot of my personal work happens when I need to transition drums. Because a lot of my books are made as I'm transitioning drums because I don't want to waste 1,000 prints. So I'm like, okay, let's make a weird striped, blurry photo book that I can never reproduce because the colors aren't accurate.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how they come out. But a lot of times they're also just, I have something to say, I have a lot of photos. So I would say my personal work tends to have a bit more of an urgency of just like, I need to make this thing.
Yeah.
And then
it also seems to make really make sense with the aesthetics of a drum shifting.
Yeah.
Just like how you've been talking about everything and then a bit of a memory shift.
Yeah.
You know, and capturing a specific moment that is also changing simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then, yeah, the books with other artists, we usually have a like, oh, it'd be great to have it ready for this fair.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So
the lax deadlines approach is something that I do really appreciate. And I think is important to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, that's a lot of stress you don't really need to take on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I can imagine that your collaborators might not really like that all the time.
Yeah, it's. But I would say that, like, an artist who needs a deadline to get a thing done, I'm not the person to make a thing with anyways.
Yeah,
yeah. Because also, like, we can have a deadline, but something might come up. Which I think is also really important with the Rezo, because like the Rezo might break. Or as we've experienced for the last couple of years, like there just might not be cream paper for 6 months. And so, okay, like we gotta wait.
Yeah.
And that, I think that sort of flexibility, I think that's also just like the timeline of art. Like, and especially like the, I think there is a lot of art that needs to be urgent and needs to be in the moment.
Yeah.
But I also think that that's not all art. I think there is a lot of art where, like, you know, nobody might care about it for 6 years, and that's fine. I mean, that's, y'all know from tabling, like, you'll make a book that 5 years later suddenly starts selling. After five years of it sitting on your table and no one will touch it, it's like, huh, weird.
Yeah.
And then you'll,
this is the moment.
You'll sell 20 copies of a book that's 6 years old for no reason. And that's okay.
Thinking about how you're working with the community too. And going back to this idea of site specificity and moments in time. You've been, you did like 5 residencies in a row recently.
I did 2 in a row.
Yeah.
With like a day in between. Yeah.
But can you talk about like what those spaces offer for you as a creative individual and how that maybe affects the work that you're doing?
That is, how do I answer this one?
I don't know if it's a little bit too close as you just got back from one.
So I would say this summer I did 2 residencies back to back that couldn't be more different.
Yeah.
I started the end of, near the end of July, I was up at In Cahoots Residency in Petaluma that's run by Macy Chadwick that is a small residency that is 3 to 5 people, and it's very, very printmaking focused. Macy herself is a letterpress book artist. It's just phenomenal. And it's an old converted horse barn that has a couple of guest cottages, and it's very much a, you go to work and like maybe go to dinner out on the coast one night.
Yeah.
And like maybe have a beer at 4 and then get back to work.
Cool.
And that is a lot of the residencies. I'm somebody who usually does residencies that are, you show up to work and the people who run the residency are like, no, let's go have fun.
Yeah.
And I'm like, nope, I need to make 2,000 prints this week. and this specific time was really, so I've been up to In Cahoots 3 times. The last 2 times have been on collaborative projects. One was an artist, Rebecca Ackerman, who we actually were making posters together the whole time, making our anti-NFT posters that succeeded, and now nobody wants them, so they're not relevant. So I got, you know, 380 of them. this time around, I was going with an artist named Sarah J. Winston, who's a photographer from upstate New York, who we met at Acre last year and started talking about making a book together, and She has a small child, is on the East Coast, I'm in California. We realized like the collaboration wasn't working from a distance. And so we intentionally went to this residency to work on something together.
Yeah.
But it was also like we did some brain time together and then did our own work like the rest of the day.
Cool.
Which was really nice.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, I fly out to the Midwest to go to Acre, which is very, very much a hangout residency. None of the spaces are really like up to you to like do really high caliber like production work. But that's kind of the goal for you to be there is to experiment and like, let's do high fire for the first time. And let's be really sweaty because we're out in a working farm and bats get into the lodge. But also like we get like top quality food every night because amazing like chefs from Chicago cook all the food. And it's a really destabilizing place. I think across the board, everyone feels really weird at first. And then you get a little bit of like utopia art camp.
Yeah.
And it's a place that a lot of people are like, why are you going there? It sounded like you hated it. And it's like, I did, and I can't wait to go back, which is weird. Yeah, I don't know if that answered the question at all. I mean, especially like since that was really kind of the Acre is kind of the main hangout residence I've ever done. And like I can say that even though like I can say like, you know, the next year I did another residency with an artist because we're working on a book together. And so like those sort of relationships happen and exist. And I think that to go all the way to what I want to say, I think it's really important to me to find collaborative relationships, and you've got to kind of get out there to do them.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to keep making work with the same like five friends, which I do have a couple of friends that I've made multiple books with. But I also like that right now, like today at the table, somebody asked like, "Oh, are these all local artists?" And I was like, "Oh no, actually, one person lives here, and yeah. otherwise people from all over." And that just allows me to make different work and use my brain differently and help different people make work. Yeah.
So one thing that you did
that meandered.
No, that is what we're doing here at Paper Cuts, especially after a fair and at the bar. But one of the things you mentioned within Cahoots is it is a very print-centered residency, and you're not just working with resale. Like you have a practice that is steeped in other printmaking processes. So to get into that, like, what other tools or processes do you use? And in printmaking, like, where did your interest in printmaking in general just come from?
So, mainly letterpress is the other print medium I'm working with. A little bit with screen print. And screen print really was my, like, entry to printmaking, what I did as a printmaker.
It's a good gateway drug.
Yeah, totally, especially being in a band. You know, I learned to screen print so I could make my really crappy t-shirts.
Quick detour, what years were you in this band?
So I was kind of in bands all throughout high school and college. And then this band, it was a post-hardcore band called Fear Before the March of Flames.
Excellent.
From 2000. And I was touring with the band from 2006 or 2004 to 2007-ish. And then I tour managed a handful of other bands.
Yeah.
That were all like other like metal post-hardcore bands.
Excellent.
Yeah. And then when I stopped touring, I joined a band in Chicago where I played two shows at a bar that didn't pay us, didn't give us free alcohol, but still charged admission. We didn't get guest list spots either, I think. Holy and I was shit. Like, I can't do this, guys.
Yeah.
And I gave all my instruments away, and I've never picked another instrument up since in 18 years.
Wow. That's an incredible like cold turkey.
Well, I think I got really lucky that when I dropped out of school, I had a faculty member who actually, I took a book arts class and like, I was just like, this is a weird class I'm taking. And
I'll never use this.
Yeah. And she told me that she's sure I'm a good musician, but I'm a better artist. And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And then after like, I was really lucky. I got the thing. Like music paid my bills for a few years. I saw the world because of music. And realizing like, oh no, this didn't fulfill me the way I wanted. And also I wasn't talented. I had talented friends. My talent is being friends. And so, like, I just had more talented people I could ride with. And so then realizing I wish I was prolific enough to do both, because I really love music, but art is really what I'm better at and have to focus on. So that was part of the cold turkeyness of it.
Yeah.
But then as far as printmaking goes, I had a gift for, I've now been to school 3 times, and every single one of them, I went to a school that had just decommissioned their printmaking department, or in the case of UC Davis, didn't have a printmaking faculty member.
Yeah.
So like there was a really convoluted person from a different department who taught printmaking for one class a quarter. And so really it was great because then the shop was mine. I got to do whatever I wanted for that first year. And then the second year, this guy, Noah Brewer, he was there as a visiting artist, which was, we're the same age, so it was more like kind of having a peer than a faculty member there. And so because of that, I have no real printmaking training. I don't really know what I'm doing, especially like real printmaking in quotes. Which then pulls us back around to all the printmaking mediums. I'm especially, I just punched my mic there, sorry for edit. I'm really into all of the printmaking mediums that are industrial. Letterpress, screen printing, Rizzo, those are all mediums that were started for a function that then became art practices. And they all live in the realm of publishing. And when I really, like, I talk about how music is kind of how I think about economics and creative practice and such, but if I really look back, when I zoom out, being the editor of my high school newspaper is really like what made me do what I do now. And like, I've been using InDesign since it was called PageMaker. And
where was high school?
Outside of Denver.
So you grew up in Denver?
And yeah, so that publishing, running a team of people, being far too earnest and thinking I was far too clever at a young age. I still have some of those newspapers, and I hope I don't feel the way I feel about my books now.
Hold on to those.
When I do, when I look at those old newspapers, we'll see. So that's, so I think that idea of dissemination of information and accessibility, like there's a little bit of that punk rockness, but also like I made a free newspaper for 2,000 people once a month as a 16-year-old. So I think that that has always kind of been a thing in my brain that, it actually took me a long time to realize that was the thing.
Yeah. So you weren't like making zines for your band as well?
Nah. Yeah. I wrote for a couple of punk zines.
What zines?
Through high school. There's one called Wonka Vision.
Was that based in Denver? Was that elsewhere?
So he was from, I want to say that he was from somewhere in Pennsylvania and then moved to Denver and then moved somewhere else. And like some large publisher ended up buying this like weird zine that he put out for
funny.
Free.
And
it may have actually been like some, if I'm remembering this correctly, like some subsidiary of Tower Records bought it.
Okay.
And was trying to do a publishing thing all before, you know, Tower Records fell apart. Maybe because they were buying up free punk zines. I don't know. but no, I wasn't doing really any of that myself. Like I was putting out records. I was making t-shirts. I was, you know, made a fake record label, like stuff like that.
So, and when you started getting back into like printing and photography after the band, was there something that like, what's the inciting incident to get back into publishing after not being editor for a newspaper for a while?
So
was there something that you saw that was like, oh yes, this?
So I have a couple answers to that, but I will try to keep brief. Part of it was that I was in, I went to school in Chicago and was making paintings, making 8-foot paintings. And then my wife took a job as a travel nurse, and so we only lived out of our car, so I couldn't carry paintings around. So I started screen printing again, which got me more into printmaking. Then coming to the Bay Area, I have the hot take that like the Bay Area is why we still care about letterpress as an art form. Because through the 60s and 70s, like we had the Patricia Curtins making the menus for Chez Panisse and like keeping this like cool counterculture art thing of letterpress before like Vandercook's cost $14,000. And so there's just this incredible history of book arts and printmaking and letterpress here in the Bay Area that I got really lucky that
my studio mate was a letterpress instructor. And so like I was in a studio that bought letterpresses right when I got there, and we all kind of taught ourselves how to use it.
That's amazing. That's a great resource though.
Yeah, it was incredible. And so I was like vaguely into making books because I had made a couple books in undergrad that were weird and not very good. And then because one of the perks to not really having a community of printmakers at where I went to grad school, because Davis is really small.
Yeah.
And because of that, I had to go out for it. And so like, you're really one of the first book artists that I talked to, like when I came to your space in New York. And
like then we went to that. 2014?
Yeah, 2014. Yeah. And we went to that show and we drank grappa, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And then like going to the book fairs, like I had to not just be somebody looking at books. I was like having to form a community that way. Yeah. And so like, I also remember like George, who now is staying at my house for this fair, like seeing his books, I was like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where the combination of what was happening in the Bay Area, really getting out into the community, like those things kind of smashed together. And then also just wanting to make stuff with friends. And you can do that in books. That's great.
Yeah.
And museums buy them. And that's incredible.
Absolutely.
I have to get that plug in that one of the main reasons, not one of the main reasons, one of my favorite reasons about publishing is that artists that would never get in collections, they do because people buy books. Museums buy books.
Yeah.
And my friends who do performance art, SFMOMA is never buying their performance.
Yes.
Like, you know, so the way that I get to help be part of creating tangible legacies for artists is really cool and really special and really like one of the best reasons to do this.
It really, really is.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something that is completely reinvigorating about coming to these fairs and being part of the community is just how much the community is adamant about lifting everyone up together.
Yes.
And that I think is something that is very hard to find in other parts of the art world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's especially true about Rezo World.
Yes, absolutely.
Because we all know it's a really dumb thing to do. But I think also a lot of people who are in Rezo don't come from an art background. So, like, they don't know they're supposed to be competitive.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They weren't trained on the same scarcity model that we were in art school. And I think that is part of what causes a really cool community.
Yeah, no, it's something that I really appreciate more and more and more. And as an educator, like seeing students come through and trying to push them through this other space is something I always try to do.
Yeah. Was Katana Lepart one of your students?
Yeah.
Like, incredible.
Yeah, she's great.
Like, I've still never met her, but it's like one of those people where like she's been in weird mail exchange things that I've done.
Yeah.
And like, I thought that somehow she came from you. So I was right about that. You fall into her lineage, I should say. And like, that's exactly it. Where it's like, oh, you make some weird book things. You make some cool book things. Like,
yeah. Those connections we made across geographies and spaces and communities were just like, oh yeah, you know this person that I know.
Yeah, exactly.
This weird.
I mean, I sent you an email because I saw a book of yours once.
Yeah,
and you want to come hang out at your house. Like that's, and still like that's what I love doing. It's like somebody's like, hey, I'm in town.
That's
you have
a Rezo?
Come on over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
It's like, do you want to talk to me for an hour?
Yeah.
We may have met.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. Well, Zach, I'm so glad that we were able to like pull this full circle to
me
our
too.
First meeting.
I know, it's perfect. Yeah, we really actually should have been drinking grappa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now I think about it.
Yeah.
And as a quick correction, it is not just grappa, it is a Greek moonshine called Tipro. I'd be yelled at from family members
fair.
If I did not make that correction
on me.
Yeah. So next time we hang out, I'll bring a bottle of moonshine. Not the Tipro. Do that again.
Perfect.
Can't wait.
Rex,
thank you. Really wonderful.
Yeah,
great. We should probably get another drink.
Yeah, let's do it. To speak, my teeth fell out. You helped me put them back. Words are
define in many different phrases. I use some of these in some.